The 1995 Sandstone Symposium presents Session Number 290, Pillars of My Faith, with Albert Eugene Peck, Cole Kapner, Barbara Hua, and Martha Sontag Bradley. This is the first of two tapes.
I'd like to invite everybody to come in and have a seat. And I'd like to welcome everybody to the 17th Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. I'm Kent Frogley. I am the Vice Chair of the Sunstone Board of Trustees. And it's nice to gather tonight in what has historically been one of my favorite sessions here at the symposium. And tonight, I think we're gathering in a particularly beautiful setting. I'd like you to notice all of the paintings and pastels that are scattered around the room. This is a preview of the Sunstone Art Auction, which will take place tomorrow from noon until 7 o'clock. This represents less than a quarter of the pieces that will be on display and available for bid. So I'd encourage you to look at the pieces, and tomorrow come and bid on something that you like. All of the money that this raises will go to help Sunstone continue. We'd like to begin this evening by having a prayer. That will be offered by Donna Wald. And then I'd like to introduce our panel for tonight.
Our dear Heavenly Parents, we're grateful to be able to be here tonight, to be together with open minds and open hearts, with love and caring for each other and for Thee. We pray that those dear people who are going to give us their testimonies tonight will be blessed, that they can say the things they want to say in the way they want to say them, and that our hearts will be open to hear them, to hear those things. We pray that that will help us to have open minds and open hearts in all that we do. And we're grateful for our blessings. And we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
I'd like to introduce the individuals who will be participating this evening in our session. We're going to follow the order in the program, which I know is a relief to Albert. He put himself first on purpose so he could relax and enjoy the rest of the panel. Albert Peck will speak first. He will be followed by Cole Kapner. We'll have a rest hymn, an original piece written by Christian Asplund, and Greg Campbell will be our chorister. Following that, Barbara Wheeler will address us, and then Marty Bradley. And the closing hymn will be Amazing Grace. And Major Dennis McAllister of the Salt Lake Scots and Pipe Band will accompany us, and we'll conclude with a prayer by Jeffrey Lyons. Albert Peck, as you all know, is the... Albert, what are you? The executive editor, director, publisher, Sunstone magnate, and... He's the individual, along with help from a lot of his friends and colleagues, that puts this together every year. I've known Albert since 1985 or 86, and he's become a very close and dear friend to me. And he's somebody that I admire greatly, and I respect his insights into theology, into the human experience, and into situations and ideas that are that we as Mormons confront. Albert, just for his credentials, graduated from Brigham Young University with a degree in political science and philosophy, and then he returned and received a master's degree in public administration. And he was an urban planner for a while, and then came to Sunstone in 1986. He will be followed by Cole Kapner. Cole Kapner received his BA from the University of Utah and his Juris Doctorate from George Washington University. Currently, he is a partner in the law firm of Baker McKenzie in their Hong Kong office. and he's also the Elders Quorum president. Cole is also a friend of mine. I met Cole in New York City when I was living there. He lived in Brooklyn, and he used to come over to my apartment on occasion, and he's also somebody who I admire the power of his mind and his ability to analyze and confront different ideas. Barbara Wheeler, who will follow our rest hymn, is a DSW, and for 15 years she was, or I'm sorry, for the last 5 years she was the director of the School of Social Work at BYU. She spent 15 years on the faculty. She now has emeritus status there. And she's currently a clinical social worker with a practice in Park City. She'll be followed by Marty Bradley. Marty Bradley is also a very dear friend of mine. I met her when I first came on the Sunstone Board in 1980-something, when Peggy left, whenever that was. And Marty is somebody who just has an incredible sensitivity to people and a huge heart and a lot of compassion for what people face. She currently is a teacher in the School of Architecture at the University of Utah, and she has a PhD in community history. She made me promise that I wouldn't say that she organized the Sunstone Symposium, received her PhD, and gave birth to her sixth child all in the same year. So I won't tell you that. And I just can't say enough about Marty Bradley. So we'll follow the program in that order.
I've, for years, played around with how people have titled their Pillars of My Faith. For those of you who've been a frequent attender of these sessions, you know that many people end up rejecting the metaphor of pillars and replacing them with other metaphors. Mary Bradford replaced it with pillows of her faith, which she could rest her head on, and we'll go. I have named my pillars of my faith the remnants of my faith, which is not as cynical as it may seem at the start. I think my faith, I grew up and my faith was cultivated in a wonderful culture that, the way I remember it, it could have been a Frank Capra movie or a Norman Rockwell painting. I had wonderful parents who loved me and took me to church and had a very realistic view of church and would talk about the people in the ward. I grew to love the members of the various wards I was in. My parents belonged to incredible study groups, just heroes, everyday heroes, people who I still feel, even though I haven't seen them for 20 years, if I called them and told them I was Gina Nelda's son, they would come at 3 in the morning to help me. I felt very connected, had wonderful ward leaders who mentored me spiritually and intellectually. I blossomed socially within the church's organizations, Hill Cumorah pageant trips, which were spiritual feasts, youth conferences, many opportunities to serve and to plan and to organize and to be valued and to show that I had value and to help friends and be helped by them. My spirituality and my sociality came together and were one, and they were within the Mormon community, within the ward structure. It was just a wonderful time period. Emma Luthane described her pillars of my faith as a great sea that supports and buoys her up. I feel the same way about my growing up in the church. It was just a wonderful experience. I learned to love God, and as the way many teenagers would bear testimonies at youth conference, they'd say, I know the church is true, and I love every one of you. In the same way, my testimony of the church and of God was so linked to the people I grew up with. They were one and the same. That emotional, spiritual binding of those of both of that was such an incredible experience. BYU provided the same experience for me to serve, to be served, to love, and to be loved. My mission was an incredible time. I remember once on my mission when I was working in Santa Rosa, California. There was a period for 4 or 5 months where I really felt that I had looking back on that, the attributes of charity. And I just like to read those from Corinthians because they described me at that time. This is from a different translation, where it talks about how love is patient and kind, envious, no one is never boastful, never conceited, never rude, love is never selfish, never quick to take offense, love keeps no score of wrongs, takes no pleasure in the sins of others, but delights in truth. There is nothing love cannot face. There is no limit to its faith, its hope, its endurance. Love will never come to an end. That's how I was during this time period. I loved everyone, the jerky missionaries, the members who wouldn't help us. And I felt calm, and I felt at peace. I would wake up in the morning and feast upon the scriptures, and my companion who refused to tract and just took pictures all day long, I loved him. And maybe for that reason. At that time, one of the popular songs on the radio, which we listened against mission rules, was Olivia Newton-John's Have You Never Been Mellow? And to me, that song spoke to that mellow feeling I felt of a peace with myself, with God, and with everyone I met. It was a wonderful time period. I've had experiences like that since then, sometimes through church calling, sometimes not on my own. And they've always given me a goal that there is a spiritual level of peacefulness and calmness and contentness that I can achieve. And so it's never been some abstract thing that I've read in scriptures. It's been an experience. My mission provided me also with other spiritual experiences, which blossomed after my mission, as I served in several Elders' Quorum presidencies and as president. And as I came, primarily through reading Parley P. Pratt's autobiography, to love the concept of the church being the kingdom of God in embryo, and it's our job to help Christ come by building his kingdom here on earth. The idea of establishing Zion gave my whole life a unity and a purpose and a love and a passion that defined my life for many years. That was all very good, and I am very grateful for all of that, and it is still very much a part of me. I don't feel disconnected from that aspect of my life at all, although I understand a lot of those feelings and thoughts somewhat differently at times. Then came a period where much of what I believed, I no longer came to believe. I think it began when I was working at the Missionary Training Center as a research assistant, and my bosses were general authorities, and we had regular reports on the inner politics and workings of the brethren, particularly concerning missionary policy. It's quite discouraging to me, because the notion I had of prophetic leaders just was not evident there. So I had to ask myself the question, well, what does this tell me about how God operates among humans? And I had to begin revising and increasingly adding a human overlay to any belief I had in divinity working through human leaders. Then I started studying Mormon history and found the problems I discovered with contemporary church history multiplied a lot. And that plus coming to realize how so many things are bound in one's culture and one's context, I began to doubt everything that I believed, whether it was, and maybe it was all just socially constructed, and the feelings I had were socially constructed and given to me by my culture and my community, and what indeed was true. And I was seeking for an absolute truth, no doubt. I remember once, I'd like to tell two experiences from this time. Once I remember walking home from work across the parking lot and the church office building, or next to the church office building, and thinking, what do I believe? Do I believe this? I don't know. Do I believe that? No, I don't believe this. Do I believe this? No, I don't believe that. Do I believe Joseph Smith was a prophet? I don't know. Do I believe Jesus Christ was divine? Maybe, although that was hard because I'd had real spiritual experiences with Christ. Do I believe God is the Father? Probably, but that's not absolute. What do I believe? And everything was stripped away down to, I believe that there is a spiritual side to life. That's something I could not deny. I'd experienced it so many times in so many ways. I could not deny it because I didn't want to live a life without any sense of spirituality. And from that experience, I had to recreate my life. And that's where I get the title, Remnants of My Faith. Many things which I once believed, I no longer do believe. What remains of my belief, however, I am much more sure in my belief, in those remnants. And of those remnants, I feel this similarly about my life as the prophets would prophesy about Babylon and Israel being carried into Babylon, and how God would take a righteous remnant back to Israel to build a new kingdom. I feel that has been done with my remnants. I wandered in the wilderness. I was carried off into Babylon. And the remnant of my faith which came back, I have built a new and stronger faith from that. Another experience I had during the same time period, which was long before I became editor of Sunstone, was I had the occasion to go down to BYU on some errand. After I fulfilled the errand, I took a nostalgic walk around the campus. And I walked around the dorms and remembered my dorm life, and I walked to remember some of my favorite classes, and I'm sure many of you have had a similar experience. It's quite nostalgic, quite sentimental, quite self-indulgent. Oh, woe is me, what has happened to me? I'm weeping by the waters of Zion, even, not even Babylon. And I started wandering through the maze of halls and secret passageways in the Harris Fine Arts Center. Entered through the back way into the Pardo Theater, where our ward met once when I was a student there, and when I was Elders Quorum President, which had been a blessed time of community. I sat on this stage, which was dimly lit, and looked down into even a more dimly lit hall, and began remembering all of the individuals in that ward, and how much I loved them, and who they were, and their quirky personalities, how much we had shared testimonies and service and given blessings to each other. And I felt very dry at that point compared to that previous time. And I started to weep sitting there on the edge of the stage. And the closing words to a poem that Robert Frost wrote came to me, one that I had memorized or tried to memorize. And it's from his poem, here's the line. It says, "Here are your watering places. Drink and be whole again beyond confusion." To me at that time, those words meant that here in the community of saints is where I found nourishment and strength. Here was where I was watered and refreshed. From that time, I began returning to the community of the saints, a different person than I was before. So community has become a pillar of my faith. I don't think it's the core pillar of my faith. The core pillar of my faith is my belief in God as I understand it through the person Jesus Christ. But I think a person's religious life must be lived out in community. And let me briefly explain how I understand that, and then I'll be through. I see much of my life trying to understand God. In fact, I understand my life as a spiritual journey. And I understand my articulation of that as a dialogue with God, that is a lived conversation. Sometimes I'm living in dissent with God and saying, I don't agree. Sometimes I'm living in assent and saying, this is wonderful. I feel a friendship with you. I feel part of you. Sometimes I speak out loud the way Tevye does in Fiddler on the Roof in talking to God. But much of my life, most of it is my life. The quote from the Lectures on Faith has always resonated with me, where we need to know that our life is that the course we are pursuing in our life is agreeable to God. I want to live a holy life. I believe a holy life is possible. I have tasted it at times in my past, and I want to have that. At the same time, I'm not sure I understand exactly what a holy life is. I've come to believe that everything I think and know are metaphors. I understand life through the categories and language that my culture and my religion has given me, and they are not absolute truth. We could go on to that more, but I hope most of you understand what I mean by that. I don't even know for sure whether Jesus Christ really was who he said he was, or whether my understanding of Jesus, which has changed so much over time, is but a category. However, I do know that I feel a spirituality, that whatever God and divinity is able to speak to me through that person who I've come to know as a person, and who calls to me to live this better life. And on a day-by-day basis, Jesus is very real to me. And the life that Jesus calls me to live is very real to me. And yet I can step back abstractly and say, that may all be a metaphor, a symbol, whatever you want to call it, that God is willing to speak through to me. And in some other culture, he'll use other symbols. That's entirely a possibility. I do not know that. I just know that I am trapped in my time with this symbol, and it works very well. Similarly, I believe the same is true about Mormonism. I am in the Mormon culture and in the Mormon community, and I find the Mormon ideals very attractive to me. The concept of growth and progress, the concept of making heaven here on earth, that of service to other people, of living life in community, the equalitarian messages in the Doctrine and Covenants, and it calls to social justice. They all speak clearly to me and define my life, and I feel the spirit very agitated and animated about those. I have no idea whether they are absolutely true, whether God really spoke those exact words and wants me to know them. But it really doesn't matter to me, because even if I gave up all of those categories and tried to find the absolute truth, I would be trapped in some other categories. If I gave up this culture and moved to some other culture, however excruciating that psychological work would be, even if it was possible, which probably it isn't, I would still be trapped with that sense of arbitrariness. So I choose the things from my Mormon culture that I feel the spirit that I've learned through my life works. And those that don't, I'm happy not to live with them, and they don't bother me too much. That is my journey. That is my conversation with God as I work on something, and eventually I say, this isn't good. The spirit doesn't really resonate with me on this. And I have to abandon it. But sometimes I hold on to something for a very long time when I don't. That is a scary life. It's a life of freedom, and it's a life of friendship, and it's a spiritual journey. The dangers of it, I think, must be checked by living in a community where your life is not only in dialogue with God, which you can often create in your own image, but your life is also in dialogue with a believing community who can say to you, that doesn't look right, or we value that, and we don't value that. And I believe our lives need to be lived in a religious believing community for that checking, as well as for the opportunities to love and serve, and be loved and served. So I guess those basically are my two pillars of my faith, a loving community of saints, and a testimony of a God who calls me to live a life. I'd like to conclude just by reading one of the passages that just resonate to me. I have a passion for the New Testament and New Testament scholarship. Parts of it now I read and I can totally dismiss and say, that's just Paul speaking. Other parts, when I read and whenever I read them, they just say to me, yes, this is how you can be. This is how you should live. They're the same themes that were in 1 Corinthians. They're the same themes that are in the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. It's the message of Paul that we can put on new creation. With the Spirit, we can become a new creature. We need to be children of light instead of children of darkness. Here is Paul in Galatians. Heavens that a Mormon reads Galatians. But where he says, anyone can see the behavior that belongs to the unspiritual nature. Fornication, indecency, debauchery, idolatry, and sorcery, quarrels, a contentious temper, envy, fits of rage, selfish ambitions, dissensions, party intrigues, jealousies, drinking bouts, orgies, and the like. I warn you that no one who behaves like that will ever inherit the kingdom of God. But the harvest of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, fidelity, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no such law. There are so many similar passages of pastoral counsel in the New Testament, particularly in the epistles of Paul, that whenever I read them, whether they're in Ephesians or Colossians, that passage which says, you need to live the fruits of the Spirit, be a children of light, put on a new creation of love, of gentleness, of kindness, of meekness. That is a spirit that calls to me, and I feel an affinity with Jesus who does that, and that's why I need a community to do those things with. I feel somewhat embarrassed to talk about those issues because people who work with me on a close basis, I think, know how much I don't possess those attributes, and I genuinely feel guilty about them all the time. I don't feel guilt about a lot of things, but I do feel guilty about not acquiring those traits as gifts of the Spirit. I like having the remnants of my faith work a new creation in me. I feel freed from so many of the trivial concerns that can divert us from those issues that the Spirit, I think, at least in my life, is so agitated about. I don't find the Spirit concerned very much with picky doctrinal points and administrative concerns. But I do find a spirit that calls and haunts me to become a new creation. And there may be a better way of articulating it, but I am in the Christian Mormon tradition, and I love that tradition, and it works very well for me, and the Spirit seems to be able to speak to me very well on those core issues. And those are the few remaining, but very real and strong beliefs. That there is a God, there is a divinity and a spiritual side of life, and humans can change by connecting with that individually as well as in community. Thank you.
Thanks, Albert. I for one, certainly enjoyed that and certainly share in some of Albert's feelings. And I think I attended my first Sunstone Symposium in 1984, and despite living in Beijing and Hong Kong for 6 of the past 12 years, I've tried to make it a point to return every year to attend. I think, as a result, both the United Airlines and I have benefited from that. Over the years that I've attended this section, the Pillars of My Faith, has been one of my favorite sessions. When Albert, I actually sent in my registration to attend the session, not to participate, but Albert sent a fax back and said, please participate. And he invited me to participate in this session, which he described as a session with a little soul bearing, a little spiritual journey, a little intellectual testimony about the concepts and events that animate my religious life. It is a night of self-reflection on the things that matter most to me. Actually, I'm not sure why I've always enjoyed these sessions, because they've reminded me of testimony meeting. And to start off the soul-bearing, I don't really like testimony meeting. In fact, I've never liked testimony meeting. I wish it would have remained on Thursday nights, and I wouldn't have felt compelled to go. In fact, it's pretty serious. I have a hard time getting out of bed on the first Sunday of the month. You know it's serious because in Hong Kong, my ward starts at 1:30 in the afternoon. But I do feel honored to share the panel the participants today. I enjoyed Albert's remarks, and I look forward to hearing Barbara Wheeler's and Marty Bradley's. I also am grateful for the opportunity to have a chance to be forced to reflect on what I believe. And so, in the words of S.I. Hayakawa, I'm permitted to speak my mind because I have nothing to lose. So I'll go forward and share with you my thoughts and feelings on the critical issues of faith that I've confronted so far in my life and my journeys, having the opportunity to live in the United States in several cities and in Asia two or three times, and now having the opportunity to live in Hong Kong. I still remember vividly as a child of five growing up in Bellevue, Washington. Our backyard had a wooded area, and I would frequently go out and dig tunnels, thinking that I would somehow be able to dig deep enough and come out in China on the other side of the world. Well, my sense of geography improved having served a mission in Taiwan. And I was privileged, I think, to have a mission president who was a professor of Chinese literature, Thomas Nielsen, who introduced me and hundreds of other missionaries to the wisdom of Chinese philosophers, which previously had been known only to me in offensive ethnic humor. One of those philosophers, the great sage Confucius, referring to his own progression through life, is reported to have said, "At 15, I thought only of study. At 30, I stood firm. At 40, I had no doubts. At 50, I knew the decrees of heaven. At 60, I was no longer argumentative. At 70, I can follow what my heart desires without transgressing what is right." If life proceeded inexorably from ambiguity to certainty for Confucius, just the opposite course seems to have befallen my life. As a kid, I seemed so sure of myself and practically everything else. Now it seems everything I thought I knew is subject to reinterpretation. The faith of my early religious indoctrination, so rigidly absolutist, has been replaced by a much more fluid, dynamic, and less certain worldview. I believe, like Paul, that now I see through a glass darkly, struggling to harmonize or reconcile, as the case may be, the church's teachings with my own life experience and perceptions born thereof. The result of this process is that I must pick and choose among the teachings of the church. And despite criticism from my friends, both mainstream and heretical, that I'm the Mormon counterpart of a cafeteria Catholic, I'm comfortable with the tensions that selection process creates. In truth, of course, I believe that everybody down deep must confess to the same thing. Whether we're willing to acknowledge it or not, we all pick and choose, and that's the way it should be. To do otherwise would amount to a forfeiture of our God-given right to think and to choose. Despite what anyone may say, religion is intensely individualistic and personal. We each create our own belief system from a smorgasbord of choices. So as a cafeteria Mormon, it's okay for me to like ice cream, but not Jell-O, scones, but not scrambled eggs, French fries with pink fry sauce, but not green punch. Today I have the opportunity to describe specifically some of my gastronomic preferences. This my shift from architectural motif to food. I know nothing about architecture, but I know a little bit about food. First, a bit about where and how I developed my appetite. I was born on a rainy day in Seattle. That's redundant, I guess. Sometime during the Eisenhower administration, my paternal grandmother who was a rabid Democrat, used to say that the United States didn't really need a president, and Eisenhower proved it. I was born of goodly parents, not exactly by church standards. Mom and Dad were those type of Mormons you don't see too much anymore. They would attend church on major holidays and were called as the ward drama directors. They didn't come to church, but we had the best road shows in the area. My father was a successful advertising executive, very strict, conservative, the son of Mormon pioneer stock from England and Scotland. But a combination of inactive parents, extreme doubts about Joseph Smith, and a drinking problem, which he later overcame in life, kept Dad from activity in the church. My mother, while sharing Dad's lack of real interest in the church, was his opposite in every other way. Where Dad was strict, she was permissive. Where he was conservative, she was liberal. Where he was fettered by a strong sense of responsibility, she was a free-spirited nurse and model of Italian ancestry. An ancestry I'm convinced must explain my affinity with China. I'm convinced that Marco Polo was somehow in there. But irreconcilable conflicts between my parents led to their divorce when I was age 9, and my mother packed up her 3 children and returned to her hometown of Ogden, Utah, where, as a single mother, working mother, she raised us. It was there that my religious life began to take form. At age 11, I had my first religious experience, an overwhelming feeling of guilt following experimentation with tobacco and alcohol. On my own, no doubt to expiate for my sins, I began attending church and have continued that practice to this day. But I was an impressionable youth growing up in a conservative Mormon neighborhood, and I acquired a belief system which was ripe for disenchantment. To be sure, I'm grateful for the many worthy teachings and values I assimilated during that time, for the Christ-like examples of salt-of-the-earth people like Wayne and Elsie Walquist and many others. I credit these fine people and the efforts of countless other church teachers for having a very positive influence on me and my peers, and for developing in me a commitment to integrity and other important values that comprise my present value system. But that same environment stressed absolutism, infallibility of leaders, conformity, unquestioned obedience and orthodoxy over attributes of searching, questioning, human fallibility, individualism, and intellectuality. I was inculcated with a belief system that, is by its precarious nature, set the stage for a catharsis in a still young but maturing believer. And human experience and church history, which my seminary teachers warned me to stay away from, became the catalyst to reexamine my uncritically held beliefs. I was taught in church that there were keys with which everything from my financial security to family happiness could be obtained. Want a family free of problems? Have family home evening every Monday night. Want financial security? Pay your tithes and offerings. These were keys that were guaranteed to unlock the blessings of heaven. Everything was presented to me in stark, absolute terms. Follow the brethren, everything will be fine, and prophetic infallibility will protect you. Then, sometime during my early 20s, it suddenly occurred to me that human experience didn't bear out the existence of such guarantees. There was a lot more gray than all that black and white I'd been hearing about for the past 10 years. While still clinging to my naive and absolutist notions of prophetic infallibility, I discovered church history replete with contradictions, prophets not acting as prophets should, or at least as I had been taught that they should, prophets as money diggers or teaching doctrines which today general authorities label as heresy. Doctrines not revealed from God all at once, but gradually and inconsistently. In my rigid belief system, I had no flexibility nor capacity to accept the human element in our religious experience. The cognitive dissonance grew to a head and pushed me to a brink. A decision had to be made. I could maintain my rigid belief system and continue to deny reality. I could jettison the whole package and leave the church altogether, or I could reformulate my religious orientation. It was then that my epiphany occurred, and I made a decision for which I will always be grateful. I came to appreciate that my religious expectations at the time were not just unrealistic, they were unfair. Recognizing that the church and its leaders can and do err was an important transition in my reconstituted religious worldview. It did not destroy my faith, it strengthened it. Despite their human weaknesses and base instincts, just like mine, these prophets accomplished and continue to accomplish many great and wonderful things. I came to grips with prophets making mistakes and recognized that I should not lose confidence in leaders' ability simply because they, like me, are merely human. I began to make choices, choosing tenets, principles, and values that were consistent with human experience or had the capacity to elevate it. I came to believe in the church in a new way, in part for what it says it is, in part for what I think it is, and in part for what it can potentially be. With this new religious worldview, I felt emancipated. I felt like I imagined Peter must have felt when he recognized that the principle-based gospel of Jesus Christ was intended to replace the rigid absolutism of the Mosaic law. And I embarked on a struggle not to forsake entirely my past religious practices, but to convert the motivation for such practices from habit and obedience to heartfelt desire. This life and not the next assume greater importance. When a disciple asked Confucius about spirits and gods, he replied, "You cannot treat spirits and gods properly before you're able to treat your fellow men properly. You cannot know about death before you know about life." I began to appreciate the wisdom of this teaching. I also began to explore the thinking of other religious writers. I admired Aquinas, Abelard, Moore, Luther, Bacon, Kierkegaard, but I found my religious thinking more profoundly influenced by contemporary Mormon thinkers. Mormon teachers like Lowell Bunyan, Sterling McMurrin, George Boyd, Art Bassett, Dale Lescheminon, Carlisle Hunsaker. New pillars of my faith emerged and have been refined and redefined through the years, but keep me a devoted, albeit unconventional, member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What then are those pillars? Call me strange, but I happen to like going to church, with the exception of testimony me. Not for the society, but for the worship. Sunday church meetings are a pillar of my faith. I recently wrote to a Chinese friend who was from Beijing, was doing graduate work in Finland, and who had been tracked out by the missionaries there. She had written to me to let me know that she was reading the Book of Mormon. I felt obliged to reply. Without bothering to mention the debate over the historicity of the Book of Mormon, or my own conflicted view that I'm undecided, but that I can accept it as a book of providential religious instruction, whether historical or not, I told her, quote, I like to go to church meetings, even though they're often too long and sometimes boring. Most of the time, I learn how I can improve myself or help others. I like the collective spirit that prevails there. Our worship services are too long, but I love their simplicity and their lack of liturgy. The plainness helps me think of Christ and the plainness of his ministry. From time to time over the past 15 years, I've made it a point to go to Mass and other Protestant worship services. I usually enjoy the sermons, but I miss our meetings. We probably don't appreciate how lucky we are to have a church with lay clergy. In Utah, all the attention seems to be focused on the general authorities, but elsewhere, and particularly outside the United States, the church is the members, the community of saints. At the same time, I think we're lucky to have the leaders we have by good and generally well-intentioned and sometimes inspired men. I wish it were run by good and generally well-intentioned and sometimes inspired men and women, but I think we'll have to wait for a while. I'm convinced that someday that day will come, and I hope that my daughter, if I have one, and I hope I do have one, will hold the priesthood and have the opportunity to serve as a good, generally well-intentioned, and sometimes inspired leader in the church. Like probably everyone here, church leaders make me angry and sad sometimes, but I'm not going to let those instances ruin my religious experience in this life. As important as the meetings themselves are, of equal importance is the collective spirit that I find there. As I've traveled and lived in various places around the world, I'm
chagrined to find a postmodern civilization that seems it's increasingly devoid of values. The church is an oasis of decency in a desert of morality. Amorality. To find a community of people striving in good faith to become better people, to treat other people kindly and fairly, and to emulate the values Christ exemplified is rare indeed, in my experience. Choosing values to live by is a critical component of my faith. Lowell Bunyan wrote of this process in his excellent book, The Things That Matter Most. We live in two worlds. One, the objective world of reality. And two, the subjective world of values. The world of reality is everything that exists. Nature and her laws, human beings and their institutions and societies and God, and whatever resides in this universe beyond planet Earth. As part of total reality, I feel quite powerless. I'm at the mercy of the forces of nature, which will reduce me sooner than I wish to ashes or dust. I'm also at the mercy of my fellow human beings. I sense my contingency, my dependency on forces beyond my control. My life is hardly my own. Within this larger context of total reality, I live in a second world, a world of values. It is a life of my own choosing and building. Within the complexity and multiplicity of reality, I choose the things which I prefer, things I desire, things precious to me. I place value on them. They become the things that matter most. As I decide on these values and as I live by them, I gain a sense of individuality, a feeling of creativity, an assurance of measurable self-determination. Life becomes purposeful, hence meaningful. And although logically my existence is as precarious as ever in the total scheme of things, I no longer experience my life as being powerless, expendable, or contingent. So long as I can pursue my self-chosen values, I feel alive. I affirm life with all my being. Unquote. I appreciate the church's role in providing the incubation facility for the development of individual value systems in an increasingly valueless world. And I think it's important, critical, in fact, that diversity exists in the church so that we can assure that the values inculcated are those of pluralism, tolerance, inclusion, integrity, and humility. Another pillar of my faith is my perception of the church as an institutional power in the world to do good. Recently, a Chinese friend started taking the missionary discussions, and for the first time since my missionary days, too many years ago, I attended a missionary discussion with her. I was pleased to find that the discussions had been improved, and those unwieldy flip charts, they don't use them anymore, they're just little tiny things. I hadn't seen those. But unfortunately, the distinct bias in favor of Western Christian civilization has not been removed, and that was evident teaching an atheist. I was reminded through the lessons of our fixation on religious truth. I realized that while religious truth was not unimportant to me, religious good was more important. While religious truth is, I believe, elusive in this life, religious good is not and can be achieved with the necessary will and effort. The dogma of the missionaries didn't move me like the enormous potential for good embodied in the collective will of the church. Joseph Smith once taught that a person filled with the love of God is not content with blessing his family alone, but ranges through the whole world anxious to bless the whole human race. I see in the church and its members this enormous untapped force, a huge Mother Teresa in embryo, waiting to realize a critical part of its divine mission. One of the general authorities who previously served in the Asia Area Presidency in Hong Kong recounted to me an incident that may have had a material effect on the church's recognition of its own role to do good. When President Kimball was planning to visit Hong Kong, this general authority submitted an application to a public stadium in order to use the facility as a meeting place for the members. To his surprise, the Hong Kong government turned down the application, claiming that the church did nothing to contribute to the good of the community. It engaged in no organized community service. It provided no welfare or educational services like other churches in the territory. Its only activities were proselytizing. Armed with this reaction, this general authority convinced other church leaders to allow missionaries to engage in regular community service. I think this is what George Boyd called the horizontal revelation. Imagine the power to succor the needy if, in addition to the 50 or 60,000 full-time missionaries regularly rendering community service, they were joined by 9 million members. Imagine the influence for good we could have and the attraction to those seeking to do good. We could become known for Christ-like service rather than a people who avoided caffeinated drinks. The church's humanitarian assistance program is fast becoming a major part of this pillar. 2 weeks ago in sacrament meeting, I heard Brother Ted Christensen, a self-described welfare agent of the church, describe his role as one of the church's humanitarian assistance missionaries with responsibility over Asia. My heart stirred as he described the church's development and relief assistance programs minister in Pakistan, India, Mongolia, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Indonesia. The church is actively succoring the needs of these far-off lands, irrespective of religious affiliation. Surely we as a church are beginning to range throughout the world, blessing the whole human race. As I move down the cafeteria line, from entrees to starters, from practices to doctrine, two key doctrines are central pillars to my faith. It doesn't matter. The first is the notion of a loving, personal God as taught by Joseph Smith. It doesn't matter to me that it took a while for Joseph to come to it. His concept of the body parts and passions with real knowledge of the human experience is the only God that I can have faith in, whom I can have faith, and to whom I can meaningfully pray. For me, the love of God becomes real from this kind of God, and Paul's teachings in Romans 8:38-39 ring more true. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God. I've always thought it is easier to believe in God as a general proposition than the specific and peculiar tenets of Mormonism. After all, the sublime opera of Mozart and the splendid beauty of Bryce Canyon were proof enough to me that a supreme being must exist in the universe. But it's really with Mormonism's limited but progressing God that I can truly identify. Deity who struggles along with me. I like that notion. The second doctrinal pillar, without which my cafeteria selection would not be complete, is my belief in the Jesus of Nazareth. I believe in the Jesus of the New Testament, and like Albert, delight in that book. While my image of Jesus has certainly been influenced by Joseph Smith and Talmage, I have a hard time accepting it's the same Jesus in the Old Testament and the Doctrine and Covenants, unless he has a multiple personality disorder. But I don't accept the views of the proponents of higher criticism either. I've read those who try to define the historical Jesus, and I find their work interesting, but the arrogance of their certainty is as unfortunate as that of the mainstream crowd. In any case, none of this detracts. none of this detracts from the central tenet of my faith, that God sent His Son to this world to teach us, to inspire us, to love us, and to save us. Through a leap of faith, I believe in both the virgin birth and the resurrection. More importantly, I believe our individual lives become more meaningful as we strive to emulate the unconditional love Jesus exhibited in service to our fellow men and women. I guess you can say, like Albert, I am first a Christian who chooses to express his Christianity through the vehicle of Mormonism, my own brand of Mormonism. It may be somewhat different from your brand, but that's okay. In conclusion, as I approach the future, I long to have the confidence of Confucius, but I do not expect it. Instead, I live with the faith I have selected day by day. I don't pretend to know all the answers or even most of the questions. But the pillars of my faith provide me with the sustenance and spiritual nourishment I need to go forward in my pursuit and personal quest for a more meaningful life. Thank you. I'm hoping that everyone brought his or her copy of the program. If not, the Sunstone, the two Sunstone staffers who've come to be known as Brian and Brian, will be passing out programs just sort of in the back. If you don't have one, maybe you can just hold up your hand. The hymn we'll be singing is on page 28. And tomorrow, Christian Aspen, who's at the piano and who wrote the music for this hymn, we'll be doing a session on a hymnal that he's written called the Brick Church Hymnal. So I recommend that you all attend that session as well. Christian will play through the hymn once, since most of us, all of us, except us, maybe are unfamiliar with it. And after that, we'll just give it a try. Does anyone still need the program with words? It's on page 28. Just interrupt, Eric and Colette Singleton need to contact hotel security regarding your car. I think it's on fire or something.
The car she used to have, right? I have a wonderful piece of insight tonight that I just want to share with you. It's related to your talk, Cole. And when you're talking about a cafeteria Mormon, I realize why I like cafeterias so well. Isn't that right? I like my husband's down there. He knows I love cafeterias. And when you hear my talk tonight, you will know exactly why I have found out after listening to your talk that I like cafeterias so well. 1 year ago, my 8-year-old granddaughter embarked on a journey to gate several churches representing different denominations. She would do this making notes in her journal and then decide which church he would like to join. 2 weeks ago, 9-year-old Manda chose to be baptized in the LDS Church. I have a deep and intense respect for Mandy and her chosen process of investigation. Even though I did not have the wisdom to conduct a similar comparative study prior to my own baptism, I too experienced the feeling of choosing my membership at the age of 19 when I was baptized. In order for us to responsibly and fully accept our own existence, we must all choose our beliefs at age 8, at 18, at 28, at 48, at 98. I'm an existential Mormon. Some believe that phrase is an oxymoron, or I suppose an oxymormon, whatever that means. The fundamental pillar of my faith is made out of the ingredients from existential philosophy. It's humanistic, a term that is often used to describe an enemy to the LDS doctrine, a subject for another time and another paper. My pillar is humanistic and existential in nature, in that I believe that we as individuals are free and responsible to make choices, not a new idea, but full of depth and often unexplored meaning. There is a problem, however, here we go with the metaphor, there is a problem, however, in using the pillar metaphor regarding my faith, as pillars are human-made and not dynamic and alive. The pillar of my faith is God-made and is living and dynamic. The pillar of my faith is the simple concept that we all know about called free agency, God's gift of choice. In a sense, instead of a pillar, a more accurate metaphor would be a tree, because out of the living God-made trunk of free agency come many branches or implications for my life. When I think of a tree instead of a pillar, I'm reminded of Joyce Kilmore's line that may be altered: pillars are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. My belief in God, as well as in life myself, in my life itself, is rooted in my faith and free agency. It is utterly incredible to me that God designed such a glorious and congruent plan for our lives, a plan that has us beginning in the pre-existence, coming to a Garden of Eden such as this earth, having commandments as guides, and then returning to Him to enjoy eternal life. All of this effort God expels, and then not only says to us that we may either choose or not choose to accept His guides for living, but even gives us the instrument in which to make those choices. Think about that. Only a very powerful, omnipotent, and unbelievably being would give commandments along with the methodology that allows for not only following those commandments, but rejecting them. This concept alone would be enough to convince me that God exists and that I have a profound connection to Him. My journey in arriving at a place where free agency became the pillar or trunk of my faith was long and arduous at times, with many obstacles, questions, paradoxes to resolve, and tonight I'd like to briefly share with you three of those major obstacles which did take the form of paradoxes and have taken me years to work through. I'd like to mention how I worked each paradox through, and as a result, how my faith has grown stronger. First, a word about paradoxes. As you might know, a paradox, according to Webster, is either a statement seemingly absurd or contradictory yet true, or a statement that is contradictory and is in fact false. The first obstacle, the paradox, life is full of choices but you never seem to get any, comes from a philosopher and somebody who I think describes human nature far better than most writers that I know, and that's Schultz, Carl Schultz. You can see Lucy and Linus up there. And for those of you who can't see that very well, I will read it for you. In the first two frame, we have first two frames. We have Lucy and Linus standing there, and then Lucy says to Linus, "Life is full of choices. Now you may choose, if you so wish, to throw that snowball at me. You may also choose, if you so wish, not to throw that snowball at me. Now, if you choose to throw that snowball at me, I will pound you right into the ground. And if you choose not to throw that snowball at me, your head will be spared." And he sighs and says, "Life is full of choices, but you never get any." And that's the paradox. I know exactly the feeling. Life is full of choices, but you never get any. The paradox has two contradictory phrases, with the second phrase being false. Let me tell you why. The reality is that we do have choices. It does not feel like we have choices. It is sometimes like when our parents used to spank or reprimand us because they loved us. There was no way that felt like love to me. I still don't quite understand that. Commandments or shoulds get translated to us and by us as absolutes instead of conditions subject to consequences. As Lucy said, if you choose to throw the snowball, I will pound you right into the ground. That's the consequence. If you choose not to throw the snowball, your head will be spared, and that is a consequence. We usually don't like one of those consequences or both. Most of the time, we are choosing between a rock and a hard place, between two unpleasant consequences. So it feels like we don't have choices. For example, we may choose to go to church and risk hearing a less than uplifting sermon, or stay home and risk not getting spiritually fed at all. We cannot have absolutes and choices. If, in fact, we are to have choices, free agency, there must be options, and if there are options, there must be consequences attached to each option. This formula is needed in order to support the existence of free agency. Commandments have consequences. We choose the consequences when we choose the commandments that we will follow. In an outstanding article written by Michelle Stott entitled Of Truth and Passion, Mormonism and Existential Thought, found in Dialogue in 1989, Dr. Stott stated that the driving force behind this process of choice and consequence must be a burning religious inwardness or passion which binds us in an unshakable reliance on God. This, of course, means in part that the consequences God has identified for us are benevolent and self-enhancing. Because we often are faced with two uncomfortable choices, we abdicate our self-responsibility and blame the shoulds for our life situations. I have learned that the more I let go of the shoulds, the stronger I become and the stronger my faith becomes. The second obstacle, the paradox, we are condemned to be free, to make choices, is a direct quote from Sartre, the existential philosopher. We are condemned to be free, to make choices. In my journey toward sorting out the possible coexistence of free agency in my faith, I realized that with freedom comes responsibility, and very frankly, I was not sure I wanted to assume the needed responsibility. Short time ago, I was attempting to solve a problem in living and was exhausted and overstressed, and in a atypical overture, I want to make that clear, to my husband, I asked him to tell me what to do. I could not and did not want to think of a solution, and most of all, didn't want to accept the consequences should the decision in living turn out to be wrong. The existentialist would say that I did not want to confront my authentic self, perhaps because my actual self really measures up to the self that I wish I were or feel I should be. Herein lies another example of the tyranny of the shoulds. One time, one of my students gave me a plaque for my wall that says, "Don't should on me." Within the threat, knowing where I came from. Within the framework of existentialism, the root of all human existence is freedom, and the only way to reach a wholeness or our authentic being is through conscious choice and decision. According to the existentialists, we are responsible to choose. Furthermore, as Sartre implies, we are often not too happy about it. To us as Latter-day Saints, choosing is utilizing the gift of free agency given to us by God, and we have the right and the responsibility to do so, even though we too are often not too happy about it. In order to eliminate this obstacle in my journey, it became clear that I must accept the joy as well as the uncomfortableness and sometimes pain of choosing for myself, and learn to accept freedom and its accompanying fear as a gift from God. The third and last paradox I wanted to share with you is the one that says, be free and obey. That one really threw me. I bet I spent 10 years on that one. If there was ever a contradiction, that paradox, this is one. And this paradox is true. One of my university professors years ago confronted me on and asked me how I reconciled the fact that I was LDS and subscribed to such an authoritarian system, and yet I not only valued mental health, but had chosen it as a lifelong profession. This was a psychology professor. The professor went on to say that mental health meant that we are self-contained, self-responsible, self-directed, and self-controlled. And I thought, that's cool, that fits with free agency, that's all right. That is, if we do not abandon our self-responsibility to outside sources, thereby allowing others to control us and our lives. Already I felt a paradox coming on. I said to myself, I get it. My choice then is either I can be subjugated to spiritual authority and be mentally ill, or I can be mentally healthy and be a spiritual anarchist. What a choice. The scriptures are full of commandments to obey God's word. I even heard some refer to obedience as the first and most important of God's laws, and I'm sure you have also. For example, J. Reuben Clark Jr. stated, quote, our prime responsibility is to obey. Our prime responsibility is to obey the commandments of the Lord and to lead others to obey those commandments. The danger here, of course, is that obedience most often becomes an end in and of itself. We obey for the sake of obeying and lose the intended purpose and totally lose the element of choice and free agency. C.S. Lewis, in his book, Mere Christianity, cautioned us that, quote, we might think that God wanted simply obedience to a set of rules, whereas he really wants people of a particular sort. At the same time that we are expected to practice obedience, we are given the gift of free agency. A more important question I ask myself as a university professor some years later is, how can I be a member of a church which so strongly advocates obedience and yet tells me I have free agency? Further, as an existential Mormon, how can I congruently adopt the existential tenet that my experiencing is the highest authority and the person is free who is the author of the law he or she obeys? Also a direct quote from Sartre. These questions represented the highest hurdle for me to conquer in my quest to identify the essence of my faith. My very soul told me that it all fit, free agency and God's commandments, but I did not understand how. It wasn't until I began to actually practice making choices, eliminating the shoulds, and accompanying my fear and accepting my fear of personal responsibility that the light went on for me. Aha, I said. So, if we are all responsible for ourselves and have no power to control others, only influence others, that is, the teacher is responsible to teach, the student is responsible to learn, then the teacher cannot be responsible for learning, and the student cannot be responsible for teaching. Each must act within the limits of their own power. God is a teacher, I said. He is responsible to teach.
His primary method of teaching appears to be the giving of commandments, injunctions, directions, each followed by identified consequences. He then gave us free agency in which to choose whether or not we will obey, buy into, adopt, accept, respond, consent, conform. What all this means is that my experiencing is the highest authority because I filter all that is given to me in the way of knowledge or commandments and make the decision of whether or not I will accept, obey, at the same time accepting the consequences attached to each choice. In this sense, I am the author of the law I obey, as God's laws are subject to the positive or negative contamination of my filter. I choose to obey or I choose not to obey. This is the glorious gift of freedom given to me. The paradox comes together in a meaningful way for me. The process of grasping this concept became more important than the specific choices I have made. I also realized that my deeper understanding of free agency was to become the first step in making wise choices. The closer I am to God, that is, the more spiritually in tune I am with Him, the less risk there is for harmful contamination of my filter. From my filter, I am in a position to make more healthy choices. Isn't that incredible that God knows all of the risk involved and still trusts me? How can I not have faith in a God like that? At this point in my journey, I can look back and observe one compelling conclusion at this time, at this, and it's this. The pillar of my faith is free agency. The killer of my faith is when I allow others to threaten my free agency. There are those who misuse authority, and I have had to remind myself on many such occasions that God was never one of them. I have yet to catch God going back on His word or the promise of His gift to me. God wants choices, yet many mortals do not want me to do so. In summary, the pillar of my faith is a gift given to me by God. It is dynamic and living and has many branches sprouting out of it. It represents a 60-year-old journey in living, questioning, searching, of working through obstacles, most of which took the form of paradoxes. Some of the branches supporting my faith that have sprouted from my belief in free agency are the insight that free agency is much more complex, has many more implications than I ever imagined. I really do have choices, and many times the alternatives are extremely limited. Other times they appear limitless, but always there is a choice, and how I may react to life situations. I can freely pursue my happiness as I'm responsible for it. Shoulds are for the most part non-existent in my life. I do not always want to choose, as I cannot bear the accompanying responsibility, but sometimes I lack the needed courage. Eternal progression is a reality, and it's up to me. Learning and growing is a process representing a series of choices. Christian service means choosing to serve in behalf of others, not for others. I rely on God because I trust Him. And I connect with God because He trusts me. And so I dedicate my remarks tonight to Amanda and to her parents who have taught me so very much about respect for and trust in free agency. Thank you.
I'm a lot bigger than Barbara. You'd think after all of the years I've been teaching that I could confront a microphone without feeling the urge to start singing, "It's a little bit country, it's a little bit rock and roll." I can't. I feel like there's a little bit of Marie Osmond inside of me just wanting to come out. The name of my speech tonight is That's Not a Pillar, It's Me Still Standing. You'll know a little bit better what I mean by that in a few minutes. There is a very funny song by the folk singer Christine Lavin called Blind Date Blues that goes as follows. How many times will I have to tell a stranger my life story? It gets longer and longer and longer and longer the longer I live on this earth. How many times will I have to pretend that I'm fascinated by the ordinary details of the strangers that I've encountered on my search? I do not suffer any illusions that you will enjoy hearing parts of my story. It certainly has been an interesting exercise considering it. One of the books that I read in graduate school was written by Michael called People of Paradox, which suggests that for every assertion you can make about the American experience, you can just as accurately say the opposite. This has certainly been true for me. My life has been marked, like Barbara's, by paradox. It has been identified by times of great joy and great sorrow, of celebrations and accomplishments and wakes and failures. I have known people who have treated me well and taught me about goodness, and others who have treated me badly and taught me about evil. The route of my life has been circuitous, moving through time and space more like a spiral than a ruler. My family and eventually my career have wrapped around each other like vines running through the flowers. Each has shaped me and challenged me and defined who I am. In the same way, certain times of crisis have been key in determining the shape of my character. There was not a place in my earliest memories when I was not self-conscious of being a Mormon. Our family lived in a little red brick cookie-cutter World War II cottage in a suburban neighborhood in Livonia, Michigan. Our home was on a street lined with duplicate houses, each with a garage in back, three bedrooms on the main floor, shutters on the front windows. It represented the American dream. It was the backdrop of our lives. All the children on our street attended St. Mary of the Assumptions Catholic School, and they terrorized me, shouting taunts about the Mormon polygamous devils, chasing me for two blocks once to cut off my pigtails with a pair of scissors that grew monstrously in dreams that I had for weeks afterward. I have to tell you how lopsided this memory is, because at lunch today my mother told me that the reason they did this was because I was so self-righteously preaching to them our theory of the Godhood. I remember the really dramatic part of it, but not the reason why they had been provoked. I was sitting on the front porch of that little red brick suburban house preaching the gospel of Mormonism. Our most interesting neighbors lived next door. They were a family of gypsies, or so my mother and father said. Exotic beyond belief, dark and romantic, strange and wondrous. They accepted me, despite my Mormon background, and took me into their warm and fragrant spice-filled home. Most of our lives, however, played out in the circle of friends we had in the ward. And even though I was a little girl, 3, 4, only 5 years old when we moved, I remember all of their names, the names of the grown-ups and the children both. There was another Martha. They became my other sisters and brothers, and we formed a sacred circle larger than the family, the community the church formed for us in places outside of Zion. I remember the beautiful, stately colonial meeting house, standing on its front steps in both winter snow and summer sun, the bishop's desk that my brother and I played under, the photograph of George Romney on the wall behind the desk, because a similar photograph hung in our dining room as well. For a long time, I thought George Romney was the president of the United States and the church both, because the line for me was really fuzzy. I remember the cartoon image of the co-pilots, a chubby little airplane, surely coming out of the post-war years, that in my mind flew with Mickey Mouse and the Mouseketeers as the pilots. Because my father frequently traveled, my mother would spend lonely nights sitting on the edge of my bed singing the songs of Zion long into the night. My memories of those nights are rich. Come, come, ye saints. There is sunshine in my soul. The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning. Although she also sang Depression-era songs like Hallelujah, I'm a Bum. Hardly lullabies, these songs helped me define who we were, what we cared about, who had carried us across the plains and brought us to that moment. I was secure in that knowledge. It draped around me like a cape, and it carried me into the night. My memories of those nights are sensorially rich, As frequently as not, my mother's breath would smell like Pepsi-Cola, which she loved, and her hands smelt of Jergens lotion. Even still, when I smell Pepsi or Jergens lotion, I feel like singing, "There is sunshine in my soul today." Each summer, we drove the hundreds and hundreds of miles to Utah, the closest thing we had to experiencing a trek. We stopped routinely at Nauvoo, at Carthage. We recited the stories. We knew what they meant to our people. We reveled in our differentness. We were special because we were different from everyone else. Our location on the edge of American society was a position of great security. Eventually, we moved to Utah when my father left American Motors and began his own engineering firm. We lived with my grandmother for a while on the corner of 7th East and 8th South in a simple Victorian house, and I attended kindergarten at Hamilton School. There, much of my religious modeling came from my grandmother. My grandmother, Vinnie Mae Graff, was a strong, dignified woman whose hands were rough with calluses when we moved to Utah. She had worked all of her life as a housekeeper, a common worker, helping other families with their children and with their houses. Life had been hard for her and had fallen far short of her expectations, but she carried her burdens with dignity and grace, and I adored her. That house forms the landscape of my memory. The nubby, scratchy pink fabric of her divan, the handsome patterned walnut of her upright piano, the scissor deck on her pedal sewing machine that sat quietly in the corner of the kitchen. She brought us to her ward, the old Salt Lake City First Ward, east of Hamilton School. And I remember the cultural and ethnic diversity of the congregation, the exotic Maori dance programs that formed the center of all ward parties. She took me with her as she did her visiting teaching. In fact, one of my clearest memories of my grandmother is of her climbing the stairs of an ancient apartment building to visit an invalid member of the ward, carrying in her arms a pot covered with a cloth, dinner carefully prepared for someone I couldn't even imagine. She looked like a queen to me, standing tall and true. She had surely the most beautiful posture, like a dancer. She was a woman her pioneer parents would have been proud of. She knew who she was, despite the fact that she was poor and that she was common. My grandmother taught me about character, about integrity, and about the dignity of hard work and simple faith. I frequently remembered my grandmother's struggles later in life when my own life became difficult. We lived for a time in Santa Monica, California, and lived in the Mar Vista Ward. Our building was one constructed under the Building Missionary Program. The chapel had seats donated by a motion picture studio that swept from east to south in a half moon, dramatically tapering down to the hot pink, red, and green, floral ceramic tiles that looked like a handcrafted crazy quilt, the collective representing the diversity of the congregation that came there to worship. Mormonism was easy for me then. It bound me with individuals who were strong in character and simple in faith, dedicated to one another and what Mormonism seemed to offer us all. Almost a decade ago, we experienced a dramatically changed financial situation and were uprooted from our big, extravagant suburban house to the third floor of my in-law's house on the avenues with our six children. It was interesting to see how dramatically changed our circumstances were, and I don't just mean the physical surroundings, which was plenty dramatic enough, but we had so quickly moved from the comfortable, secure center of the mainstream church to the periphery. We no longer fit the model. Words like challenges and troubles and problems attached to us like leeches. Not knowing next what was next thing for me, an obsessive planner, and my new obsession became finding a house to rent that didn't smell like someone had died in it. But our experience living on the periphery of the church changed me, and in important ways came to define who I am, what I believe in, and who I care about, and what I stand for. It certainly was the root of the activism that has become an important part of my life today. My circle of friends changed. My good, dear suburban friends forgot us. When you have troubled times, bad luck hangs on you like leprosy, and it makes some people feel uneasy, as if your bad luck will rub off on them. But what I found was that life on the periphery was, in fact, rich. My friends that I found there have stuck through me through even worse times.
I first became friends with Kent and with Albert during those months on the avenues, and they have enriched my life with their patient, consistent friendship and wise counsel. In one of the architecture classes I teach at the university, we read a book called The Image of the City by Kevin Lynch. Lynch recommends ways we can better understand or comprehend a city, the physical shape a city takes on that speaks to the population it contains. He says we need to identify five factors, and they are path, district, landmark, node, and edge. I suggest that we consider the way those five ideas define us as a people. Only Zion might be the city we consider, the community we form as members of this church. Mormonism provides for us a very carefully prescribed path, a concept of path radically different from that of the Tao, which path reflects personal experience. Those who march along the path in unison are called saints, the faithful, the true in heart. Those who choose to follow their own path are labeled troublemakers, radicals, misguided. The path has become a boundary, a line carefully drawn, marking insiders and outsiders. In our congregations, we experience the equivalent of districts, pockets of perfect families, of broken families, of singles, the resident oddball or eccentric. You all know what I'm talking about. You already know which pocket or district you fit into. Mormons define themselves largely by landmarks, by the martyrdom, the exodus, our missions, our temple marriages, or our decisions not to go on missions or not to be married in the temple, which define our position in the community as well. The concept of node is a more difficult but equally useful concept to consider. Many of us who have spiritual lives, who value spiritual lives, have nodes that we slip into where we feel more quiet, more contemplative, or inspired, where we perceive, as William James describes it, something out there. I do this by hiking in my favorite canyons, which for me are cathedrals most potent with spiritual power, or walking at dusk, or sitting outside during the first hour of morning, which is one of the best times of the day. My daughter gets so sick of me saying it at dusk or in the morning, isn't this just the best time of the day? But they are. They're the best times of the day. During a particularly troubling time recently, I hiked in Little Cottonwood Canyon, hoping to find some peace, perhaps answers to some questions that had plagued me, and I met with a coyote standing up above me on a rock next to a waterfall. For me, that is just about as close as you can come to a personal revelation, an affirmation that life is good and profound with meaning and richness waiting for me to experience. Nodes are private places or ways we slip out of the corporate experience of the church into a more private, intensely personal experience, where, in my opinion, our spiritual lives become more immediate, more compelling, and satisfying. As for the edges of cities of Zion, consider the shaggy development of the suburbs, how different the city becomes past a certain point. Originally, Zion was shaggy at the center. Our earliest saints were a much more motley crew than we have become. But today, in the effort at correlation, at standardization, we attempt to minimalize our differences and ignore the significance of the edges. On the periphery, we experience a different culture, different physical environment. My experience tells me that on the periphery, we still need the love that the church should offer. We run parallel lives. I have in my mind the image of people who, like me, dance on the edges like the lost boys in Peter Pan. We form communities of our own around common interests, around common shared pain or joy. We define for ourselves the meaning of our lives. But in my mind, these distinctions are meaningless because the lines between us are so fine and so easily crossed. It was with these people that I shared in the experiences of the past 2.5 years, and from my own experience of once again jumping the line, joining the widow's list as a divorced person, and I have viewed the church and the community of the church from a very different vantage point. Quitting BYU 2 years ago, and the uncertainty of my new financial and marital situation and the chaos that comes in the wake of that, some of the struggles of a few of my children, the near loss of a child, knocked the wind out of me, and it feels like it has taken me forever to recover. During these 2 years, I've retreated to my room. My children, always patient and loving with me, have learned to play at my feet. My bed has become the scene of endless conversations long into the night. Here we have sought succor, healing in each other's quiet presence. The circle my children form with me is tangible and life-giving. I sat for months this past winter, gazing out the window, wondering what part of the sky would fall in next. I was afraid of the world, believing it harsh and fragile, made of glass, easily broken, not to be trusted. I hid away from my friends, from my brothers, from my parents. I continued to go to school and to teach and to research and write, but the inside part of me retreated into the dark abyss of my soul. I recognized that mine, in fact, was a crisis of the soul. There has been much talk about soul of late. The popularity of Thomas More's books, The Care of the Soul and Soulmates, attest to our generation adrift in search of something with greater meaning. The shorter Oxford English Dictionary defines soul as the principle of life in man, the spiritual part of man in contrast to the purely physical, and the emotional part of man's nature. Another writes of the soul, it is that which is most spiritual and worthy in man and what makes us human. I felt that I had lost a sense of self-worth, my sense of my humanness. There is nothing, perhaps, like failing at the big ones to drain you of self-respect. It seemed what I had lost was, in fact, a sense of my soul. Brought on by discouragement and hard times, the gap between my dreams and reality, my life seemed stark and unforgiving. Sometimes life hits us harshly in the face and causes us to wander in a wilderness of confusion and despair. Loss of soul appears in the form of a sudden onset of apathy and listlessness. The joy has gone out of life. Initiative is crippled. One feels empty. Everything seems pointless. A crisis of the soul occurs at the deepest center of our being. It is an experience that consists of much more than an intense emotional reaction to loss and trauma. Sometimes precipitously, more often imperceptibly, something essential in us steals or is stolen away, leaving us in icy detachment, incomprehensible blue moods, unimaginable emptiness, tranquilized, resistant to the tenderizing advances of Eros, lost in a raging garden wet with rain, alone at the crossroads. It involves the shattering of one's beliefs about oneself and one's life into fragments that cannot be put back together again in exactly the same way. It is an experience that forces an assessment of one's basic mode of being in the world, that compels the examination of familiar assumptions, that requires the loss of innocence and a simple worldview, that demands the rebuilding of one's basic foundation. What shamans traditionally call soul loss, we now think of emptiness, alienation, or pain in the core of one's being, where we know there was something full and vital. There is a hole where once was soul. The crisis seizes us when we're in the steely grip of grief, of betrayal, of physical terror, numbing routine, or an unauthentic life. But for whatever reason, we experience a loss of meaning in our lives. We are offered help in the effort to regain a sense of soul from many different sources. In fact, the literature is very rich. I was interested in how many of you brought books in here tonight that dealt with different issues of the soul. For instance, in Freud's Interpretation of Dreams in 1900, Freud tells us of his own arduous struggle to achieve greater self-awareness, suggesting that it is necessary for all of us to do the same, that we would benefit from a spiritual journey of self-discovery. He showed us how the soul can become aware of itself, to become acquainted with the lowest depths of soul. Perhaps to explore the personal hell we may suffer from is not an easy undertaking, but this demanding and potentially dangerous voyage of self-discovery will result in our becoming more fully human. In the process, we may achieve a deeper and more compassionate understanding of our fellow human beings. I believe that it is only through experiencing sorrow and pain that we grow. It is a terrible education that the soul receives, and it requires a terrible grief that shakes the foundation of one's being to bring the soul into its own. But being bereft of set landmarks, perhaps moral or institutional, we are in a unique position to undertake a new journey. I was moved to consider reading this past winter Barry Lopez's book, Arctic Dreams, the chance a truly difficult moment can create for us. He is speaking in this case about confronting the polar bear in the Arctic and how that experience leaves one changed. To encounter the bear, to meet it with your whole life, was to grapple with something personal. The confrontation occurred on a serene, deadly, and elevated plane. If you were successful, you found something irreducible in yourself, like seed. To walk away was to be alive utterly, to be assured of your own life, the life of your kind, in a harsh land where life took insight and patience and humor. It was to touch the bear. It was a gift from the bear. We learn from encountering the bear. We cannot recognize good, it seems, if we have not experienced or stared in the face of evil. The loss of a spiritual life, a soulful life, is a life in part based on a lack of respect for intuition. John Donne's Negative Love or the Nothing is a song of intuition. In this poem, he portrays a leap into darkness, an unknown and undefined place where the intellect has no grounding in experience or understanding. There the intellect says nothing, sees nothing. I never stooped so low as they which on an eye, cheek, lip, can pray seldom to them, which soar no higher than virtue, or the mind to admire, for sense and understanding may know what gives fuel to their fire. My love, though silly, is more brave, for may I miss whene'er I crave, if I know yet what I would have? If that be simply perfect, which can by no way be expressed but negatives, my love is so. To all which all love, I say no, if any who deciphers best what we know not ourselves can know. Let him teach me that nothing. This as yet my ease and comfort is, though I speed not, I cannot miss. What moves me in these words is the remarkable mix of humility and courage. The dichotomies he sets up, my love, though silly, is more brave. He risks following what he does not understand, walking right into the unidentified, the unnamed. What seems to be most important is that which cannot be understood, the hope of its wonder, the faith in its dimensions, its richness and depth moves him. What seemingly is the source of mystery and the unknowable is also the source of the most perfect love. Here Donne describes the primacy of intuition over intellect. What we know, study, understand, control is of lesser value. The details of prettiness, the moral virtues are of a lower sort of love, but intuition and grace, its goal, are invisible and dark, nothing to intellect, silly. Intuition goes where intellect cannot reach, without effort and outside of time. In art, Donne's Nothing is conceived of as negative space or darkness. The shadows of a building, of a shape, define the meaning of the subject. They tell us about boundaries, about edges, about hue and shade. We understand reality through the interplay of negative and positive space, nothing and the real. Boundaries, edges, profiles help us to understand both the negative and positive. We understand them separately, but we intuit them as one. Intuition tells us what is important for me, true for me, if you will. And this, then, is the place that I have reached. I don't want very much more than peace and a sense of personal truth. And I know I cannot find this by leading a life of bitterness and despair, but only through forgiveness and an attitude of faith. The difficulties of life have shown me the value of a spiritual life based on intuition, that it is here we find relief and sanctuary and succor. We cannot have a rich and meaningful life, live lives of faith and belief, if we are not in touch with our spiritual reality. Too many of us have been locked in traditional, conformist, appropriate expectations about our religious lives, allowing others to evaluate our worthiness or our spiritual positioning. We do this because we have been taught to do so since we were children, perhaps since we were co-pilots, because we feel that it is the right thing to do. We do this because we fear for our jobs, our memberships, our positions in this community. We have allowed others to tell us what experiences are spiritual experiences of value, again taking on appropriate or correct shapes. We speak of them in testimony meetings in routinized, cloned and predictable language. We keep quiet about the highly individualized and private parts of our spiritual lives that play out on the tops of mountains or in our rooms or in our heads. I have tried endlessly over the past 2 years to make some sense of the series of events that brought me to this place. The atmosphere of the last years of distrust and anxiety, of excommunication and termination, the costs have been enormous. My own life has been profoundly changed, and I wonder, how did it happen? And, you know, like in Ghostbusters, when they are on the top of the roof and they try and clear their mind, and the first thing that comes into Dan Aykroyd's mind is the image of the Pillsbury Doughboy. The thing that crowds into my mind, which is probably every bit as absurd, is that there will always be people who insist that we continue to play the game that we played as children. Who is king of the mountain? I do not believe that anyone wanted our jobs or even our memberships, but have wanted us to say uncle, to say, yes, I am weak. Yes, I need you to mediate with God. Yes, I am worthless. And even still, we refuse to do so, and we struggle to remember, yes, we are strong. Yes, we are of value. Even if you do not love me, God does. In me, there is beauty like a rock. There will always be people who will undoubtedly attempt to, almost as an exercise of will, to break us. They will ignore us. They will flatter us. Perhaps sometimes they will join us but betray us. They will attempt to buy us with irresistible jobs or honors. But they will fail to recognize our value. They will find a crack in our resolve, in our courage, and they will play on that till we bend. Inner beauty and irrepressible music, inner music, certainly the courage to resist, to say, no, you may not own me. No, you may not own my spirit, is our responsibility. Affection, regard for our own spirits is our inheritance, and it is something we must fight to retain. We must always remember both the price and the rewards of a life lived in harmony with one's soul. And the scripture that came to my mind is the same one that Albert referred to earlier. All this is a very different version. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, against such there is no law. I don't know about all of you, but I have always believed that these are the things worth living for. And I believe that it is our obligation to find our way to such a life, and I am stumbling my way towards it, and I need your help. Despite all the difficulties of the last few years, and they are many, I have also been truly blessed, and have been, as C.S. Lewis says, surprised by joy. I choose to live a life of faith and hope rather than despair. And Noah Thoreau once wrote, little is to be expected of that day if it can be called a day to which we are not awakened by our genius to a higher life than we fell asleep from. And thus the darkness bear its fruit and prove itself to be good no less than the light. I have come to believe that there are advantages in being challenged, perhaps even in experiencing a crisis of the soul. For it seems that without this impetus, we never change for good or for ill. Something needs to push us off center, off balance. To do so, we need to develop our sense of our spiritual selves so inviolate that no one can judge our appropriateness, our suitability, our worthiness, or whether we fit in. My friend's mother died this week from a brain tumor after months and months of fighting for her life. She met this with dignity, with strength, with courage and grace. She could do this because she had such a strong sense of herself, of her soul. Early on, she had a conversation with a friend who said, "Don't you feel the need to attend every meeting to be an active Mormon?" And she responded, perhaps knowing the quality of her relationships and that her life was already in order, said, "No, I will not bargain with God." Perhaps some of you can remember the scene in the film The Sin of a Woman at the end When a young student is brought before a tribunal of his peers to extract information to be used against a group of his friends who had vandalized the headmaster's car, one of the others thus accused has wiggled his way out of being dismissed. His wealthy father clearly threatened to withdraw donations. The boy himself lied, he changed stories, and then he accused his friends. Our student, on the other hand, a scholarship student with no wealthy father to defend him, receives the harsh condemnation of the headmaster because he refused to provide information. In fact, he is threatened with dismissal if he does not. Al Pacino, who plays a blind has-been soldier, rises to his feet and gives a very moving statement about the boy's sense of personal integrity, about what he stands to lose if he leaves the school, but what he stands to gain if he stays his course. One line speaks true to my topic. He says of the boy, he will do this because his soul is non-negotiable. We also need to develop and maintain non-negotiable souls. Clarissa Estes, author of Women Who Run With the Wolves, recommends a handcrafted life rather than a streamlined, standardized life, machine-produced, rendered mute and uninteresting by institutional conformity. This image is particularly appealing to me, and maybe it's because I spent so many years quilting and knitting, fingering fabric, celebrating diversity of design and texture and pattern. There's nothing quite as satisfying as drinking from a handcrafted, hand-thrown cup like those fashioned by Joe Bennion, a cup that has weight and substance, that's rough in places, whose glaze and color is unlike any other. The earliest buildings built in this environment reflect a more intimate connection to process. Adobe bricks were formed through a community dance in mud. Skirts lifted dangerously high as women and children joined in to build, to craft, a careful act, a conscious act. A handcrafted life is one that rejects the need for sameness in the effort to find ways to nourish the soul, recognizing the absolute uniqueness of each of us and the need to respect that fact. I believe that the pillar of our faith, and in saying this I mean a life that is based on faith, that life, regardless of the blows we have met, still holds out something to us that is good. That this type of faith, this kind of faith-filled life, must be centered on a spiritual or soul-filled life. I am certain that this is our work and ours alone. We cannot wait for others to show us the proper way or define the way, but we must blunder along the path, sometimes being knocked in the face with blows so hard they threaten to destroy us. But the fact that they do not, though surprising and even stunning as that sometimes feels, helps us to discover the pool of inner strength and beauty from which we must drink. We are empowered by our grief. We are empowered by the challenges that help us to rise and somehow pull ourselves out of the dark abyss to live lives once again that are full and rich and filled with hope. I would like to close by sharing some beautiful words of poetry by Ben Okri, which for me are an encouragement in this direction. We are the miracles that God made to taste the bitter fruit of time. We are precious, and one day our suffering will turn into the wonders of the earth. There are things that burn me now, which turn golden when I am happy. Do you see the mystery of our pain, that we bear poverty and are able to sing and dream sweet things, and that we never curse the air when it is warm, or the fruit when it tastes so good, or the lights that bounce gently on the waters? We bless them in silence. That is why our music is so sweet. It makes the air remember there are secret miracles at work that only time will bring forth. I too have heard the dead singing, and they tell me that life is good. They tell me to live it gently, with fire, and always with hope. There is wonder here, and there is surprise in everything the unseen moves. The ocean is full of songs. The sky is not our enemy. Destiny is our friend. And I would like to say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Chorister in the group.
Do we have the words present? Thank you. Do you start or do I? Good.
Our Father in heaven, we're grateful for this session of Sunstone tonight, and we're grateful for the speakers and for their feelings and experiences they've shared with us in the gospel. We're so grateful for the music we've had tonight also. We're grateful for thy gospel and for the challenges and blessings it gives us in our life. Bless us with wisdom and love and charity, And we ask these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.